After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
We all have that yearning for home.
Yeah.
And at the deepest level, it is the yearning for finding that inner equal poise that you were just describing so well. And getting past that alienation of separation.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling, and I'm here with Steve Kanji Rule, and known as Kanji, and you'll get an idea of his background, which is in Zen. It's kind of a combination of Zen and rural. Your whole thing in this, he has a wonderful book by Appalachian Zen, which is what we're talking about right now, about the what happened to him living in a rural area and coming out of that, kind of escaping that, whereas many people did not, as you point out in the book. So it's a strange combination that's very intriguing. So welcome, Kanji.
Oh, thank you, Raghu. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, yeah, talk about what was going on there, rural, I think, in Pennsylvania, right?
That's right.
And, what was happening, and how did you even get a glimpse of an idea that there was a way to balance truth, et cetera?
Great question. Thank you. What was happening in rural Pennsylvania when I was growing up there in the late 60s and early 70s? Is that it was an area that was culturally steeped in violence. And it was also a time, as people who lived through that period will recollect, of tremendous cultural transformation. So at that period, when I was a teenager in the late 60s and early 70s, I was very much inspired by the cultural transformations that were taking place. Of course, Ram Dass, whom you're very familiar with, was an integral part of that. So all of that was extremely exciting to me, and it even penetrated the remote area of the central Appalachian region of Pennsylvania that I was living in. But where I was living, my involvement in those transformations of consciousness was very, very unique. It was something that I was involved in almost independently of other people. So having those cultural influences of music and literature was tremendously transformative for me. But also it was a lonely journey of working my way through this culture of violence that manifested in my own personal experience as violence directed toward me personally, not within my family, which was a very loving, supportive family, fortunately, but within that environment. And so it left me with a lot of post-traumatic trauma. And eventually finding Zen practice helped me to realize a path forward. And as the book, Appalachian Zen, demonstrates, that path forward really had to do with finding the true home. And in Buddhism, the true home is that place within each of us. It's an inner heartland. We could call it original Buddha nature. It's accessible to all of us anytime and any place. It's really a matter of finding this inner equilibrium and being in this moment, in this place, and being fully alive in that with whatever arises. Hmm. And it's very healing. It's healing of soul injuries. And it was really a soul injury that had been experienced. And by soul, of course, I don't mean that's kind of perduring kind of ghost within the flesh that we encounter in Christian theology, not to be disparaging of that, but this is different. This is what I mean by soul is the deepest stratum of our psyche, that part of ourselves, which is ever-changing and impermanent, but which values intimacy and connection. And in the same way that spirit, that part of our psyche, values transcendence. Right. So to suffer a soul injury is a profound wound.
And we all got them.
We've all got them.
And by the way, I see no difference using that word soul. I mean, I have gone through so much when Ram Dass was alive and we were doing retreats with him. People would come to Maui a couple of times a year. And inevitably, because we had all of these fantastic Buddhist friends, Ram Dass in particular, but myself as well, they were always there as part of the program. And whenever he'd say soul, refer in any way whatsoever, he'd get all sheepish and he'd look and, you know, Jack Kornfield or somebody, and, you know, like getting approval, and they would all laugh. They loved it. It was so great.
Exactly.
But really, yeah, Buddha mind, soul. I mean, we have no idea what any of these things are. And we get that idea through a little bit of practice, of course. But go back to, so you're, wait a minute now, you're in school in that area, high school particularly. So was I. We're in the same era. And probably around the same age. And I was going to high school, and it was a terrorizing atmosphere.
Really?
I mean, oh, yeah. You know, I was in Montreal in a more upscale area, not where you were. So I look back and I'm like, oh, my God, how did you manage to get through it each day, given, you know, obviously someone like you had a certain sense of, you know, sensitivity that produced whatever has happened with you in this life and related to the spiritual path. But how did you navigate that day to day?
Well, thanks for asking me. Let me just hold off on that for just a moment, because I'm really fascinated by what you just said. Tell me a little bit about, let's have a discussion about how you navigated it. How were you terrorized, and how did you navigate it in an upscale area of Montreal? And then I'll share what I did.
Okay. Basically, I had gone to a parochial school. So for 7-8 years, whatever. And it was a religious school. I'm Jewish. And it was like Talmud Torah or yeshiva, that kind of a thing. It was called Talmud Torah. It's the same as yeshiva. Anyhow, my teacher, in the earliest grades that I can recall, is someone from the camps. And had, you know, he had the tattoo, the number tattoo that they all had, and was a very, I don't want to blame anybody. Poor man was just, talk about traumatizing. We can't even begin to understand any of that. But he was very angry, very unhappy, obviously. And that got transmitted. Somehow, my sensitivity in relation to this absorbed this, and school became a living trauma for me on a day-to-day basis. And then that translated in, I mean, I'm being a little bit dramatic, I'm supposing. I mean, it wasn't all bad. But for sure, that's what I do remember. And in high school, it was just a matter, so how do I defend the sensitivity? You know, I had no understanding of any of that. But by that time, I could not absorb teaching lessons. I could not absorb it. I was so traumatized in that way So then I just fell in with delinquents and, you know, I became delinquent myself to some, you know, like stealing my dad's car and going off racing in the streets like a Bruce Springsteen song.
Yeah, exactly.
I lived that. And that was my whole experience. It's so much so that I was sent away to boarding school in the States, in Connecticut. And, you know, thank God I found there was one teacher who cared. And he was a French teacher, you know, and I was taking French because I knew how to speak French because of being in Montreal. Anyhow, he basically saved my ass and I graduated from there. But I still, you know, to this day, Kanji, to this day, when I walk into, like I would take a granddaughter, take me to school, you know, occasionally because I don't live that close. But, just going into the school, it's like, I don't know, Willow, if I can handle this at this point. Tell you, that's how, dramatic it was for me.
Well, thanks for sharing that. And I can hear that we do have some things in common that resonate. So I understand what you mean about the sensitivity and needing to numb yourself to protect that sensitivity. And also having a teacher who had been traumatized himself, now being in the camps. As you know from reading the book, Appalachian Zen, I spent a week on multi-faith pilgrimage at Auschwitz. And so I had some firsthand glimpses of, that hell realm. But I can only begin to imagine what your teacher may have suffered and then what was transmitted to you as trauma in that environment.
Yes.
And then having found a teacher in boarding school who basically saved your ass.
Yeah.
In my book, Appalachian Zen, again, as you know, I also had a teacher who was very salvific for me, Bruce Bechtel, who was enduring his own trauma as a closeted gay man in a very conservative, homophobic area. But he introduced me to an entirely alternative mode of existence in a world that I barely knew existed, a cosmopolitan world outside of rural Appalachian Pennsylvania of books, and not only books, but of books in a rarefied realm of James Joyce and T.S. Eliot and Virginia Woolf. Whole new horizons for me, introduced me to classical music and to art. And not only that, but befriended me and gave me sanctuary. And because of that particular teacher and because I did have a loving home environment, I was saved from a fate that would have resembled yours in terms of stealing cars and becoming delinquent. I mean, I had my own sort of, misadventures, but I often think that if it hadn't been for a loving family and for the saving grace of a mentor, Bruce Bechtel in school, in the midst of a school that was characterized by abusive teachers who hit us and denied us the intellectual resources we deserved, I might have ended up in prison because I would have been angry. I would have been bitter. I would have seen no way out. And I would have just been defiant in a self-destructive way.
Just look at it's going on now in spades, in our schools in this country particularly. Mm-hmm. And just look from where we were in school and dealing with what we're talking about, how it seems to have advanced to even, a more difficult situation for kids that are in high school. I mean, really difficult. And look at the suicide rates of teenagers and all this stuff. It's just like it's just very difficult.
It's horrific.
Difficult. Yeah.
It's horrific. I agree with you. I think about that too. Every time there's a new school shooting or some awful atrocity that occurs, I think of that as well. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's really been a journey of healing. And this book, Appalachian Zen, is actually, to put it in context, it's one of three books. The first book I wrote, Enlightened Contemporaries, focuses on Francis of Assisi and Dogen, who brought Soto Zen to Japan, and Rumi, the great Islamic Sufi poet. Yeah. And the healing in that book is the healing of discovering the mystical path of the sacred. And by sacred, I mean a numinous reality. And a book I just finished writing, right after Appalachian Zen, The Whole Earth is Medicine, is about healing through discovering the power of the mind-body connection and the life
That's
force.
Great.
Yeah. So Appalachian Zen is positioned between those two books. And as we were saying, it's a healing journey available to all of us that really comes to a position of forgiveness and compassion, starting to realize with time and with practice that the people who hurt me and who harmed me were also very hurt themselves, very harmed themselves. And it's similar to your teacher having gone through the camps and transmitting his trauma to you and to others.
Yeah, yeah. So the first thing that I'm struck with when I read the book is, which is a through line, again, it's another through line through it, through this book, and it's the idea of what home is. And just in quoting it, sometimes we have a feeling of alienation. And that was absolutely, if there was one word in terms of my teenage years and all of that stuff with school and contemporaries and family, it was alienation. So good. I'm right there with you. We have been a wanderer and tried hard, but have never been able to reach our true home. However, we all have a home, and this is our practice, the practice of going home. So my own story, which I'm not sure you know what it is, but I'm going to mention it, is meeting Ram Dass. And, you know, I like the word you use for the teacher who gave you sanctuary, right? That's a good word. I want to kind of steal it in relation to what Ram Dass did when I first met him. I was running a radio station in Montreal. Was create this sanctuary. There was no Richard Alpert. There was no Ram Dass. There was, what do I need? What does I need to be fed by the universe in this sanctuary of just presence? Mm-hmm. And that led me to India.
Mm-hmm.
And to Ram, you know, Ram Dass talked a lot about his guru. And some of us, even though he said, I can't tell you who it is or where it is, but that's all he talked about, which he wasn't supposed to, which is a whole other trip. And we did get there, and I did get there. And nowadays, when people say to me, well, what was it like being with this, you know, an enlightened being or whatever? And the first word out of my mouth, and probably 90% of the few hundred, that's all there was, a few hundred Westerners met this being, it was home. And it was the first thing that came out. Out of the ethers, practically, to have any kind of contextuality through words that meant anything with this ineffable thing. I mean, and people who've done psychedelics understand that immediately. In fact, that Ram Dass himself said, without that, I might not have fully got, or grokked is a better word from the old days, I would not have gotten it quite that way, maybe not, but whatever it is, that was a reality for us. And so to me, now I know, I'm well aware of the Zen tradition and its relationship with teachers or quote unquote gurus is maybe looks askance at the archetypical gurus that are coming over from the East and have come here for a long time. I would have to say that I have this, Roshi Joan Halifax, I think you know who Roshi is.
I know Joan.
Yeah. So I've been doing podcasts with her forever, and she's been at the Ram Dass and been teaching in her retreats and so on. And I have this ongoing thing to the point where I said to her, I mean, I wondered, how the hell you're hanging out with Ram Dass? And he's all, you know, it's all love and devotion. And, you know, I know where you come from. It's not devoid of love, because she's one of the most loving people I know, right? So, and I said, what do you see when you look at a picture of Neem Karoli Baba. And she just thought for a second, and she said, when I look in his eyes, I see emptiness. And Ram Dass himself, when he was asked to describe it, he also said, yeah, it's just, he's empty. He's empty. And we all knew that there was no polarization anymore in this being. There was no me and you and we, them, nothing like that. And so one of the things, I'm going on and on about my thing, but we're just hanging. Okay. So
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things that I most appreciate in terms of the legacy that came back from Neem Karoli Baba, who never taught, never wrote a book, nothing. He would say things like Christ and Hanuman, the monkey god, are the same. Stuff like that. Where, you know, again, I was Jewish, so I had no relationship with Christ whatsoever when I went to India. But the reality is that Buddhist, to me, the greatest thing that comes from Buddhism is the this absolute clarity of this wisdom of being of balance, really of balance. And the only time he talked in any kind of praise was to Tibetan teachers that we were seeing around that time. I'm talking Kalu Rinpoche, Karmapa 16, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, you know, these great, incredible free beings. And and that's who we, to this day, those of us, many of us that were there back in the day, really, really relate with. And it's very much part of our practice, which includes bhakti yoga, but a very balanced one, you know, and that it makes a great difference. So I only offer that out in terms of I know, and you've said in the book, this is not the guru is not necessary, without saying it quite like that. The path is the guru, and Thich Nhat Hanh says in this next stage, the satsang, the sangha, is the guru. Anyhow,
exactly.
The idea of home, I don't think there's anything different from how you're expressing it in this book and quoting Thich Nhat Hanh than what I know it to be in relation to the legacy that I met up with all those years ago.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. And there's a lot there. There's a lot in what you just shared. In terms of alienation and finding home, you know, the ancient Greeks referred to nostos, what Odysseus was experiencing in terms of his deep yearning for home that propelled him through 10 years of getting back to Ithaca, this nostos of yearning for home. We all have that yearning for home. Yeah. And at the deepest level, it is the yearning for finding that inner equal poise that you were just describing so well. And getting past that alienation of separation. And so the emptiness that you were describing also contains everything, obviously. And it's an emptiness that contains the whole universe when we're experiencing no separation. And there is, you know, something of an innate suspicion in Zen Buddhism of gurus, to use that word, but there's also a strong...
It's like a crazy, almost, we've ruined just about every word in the English. Love, that's weak. You're weak. Love, you know, I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, that's true. When you get down to the semantics of it, whereas love is actually, it can be quite fierce and quite powerful. It's not weak at all. It's very powerful. Yeah. But Zen, also just to point out quickly, also has a strong tradition of valuing, even revering a lineage of teachers and emphasizing the lineage of teachers and the Dharma transmissions. So it's complicated in that way. But I think what you're pointing to also is the Zen tenet that ordinary mind is awakened mind is ordinary mind. And again, it's accessible to every one of us. It's accessible right here, right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been working on something that which different parts of this book really get pointed to. And it's, I have a good friend who, we do podcasts together a lot. He's very well known. His name is Duncan Trussell. And as people who listen to Mind Really know, we've been working for years on an audiobook called The Movie of Me to the Movie of We. And this fall, we expect it will see the light of day. But
great.
So here's one of the things that pointed to this. I'll just read it. The process dubbed, quote-unquote, individuation by developmental psychologists, the splitting of I from other, has been occurring, obviously, since infancy. But that epiphany at age 5, which you had, revealed a startling awareness of the split, a moment of self-conscious estrangement, a penetrating, undeniable knowing that self is separate from the world, from this world, from everything. Then it excited me. Now I recognize this, a fall from grace, a banishment from me to the triumph of ego. 38 years later, I'm trying to negate that epiphany. I think we're still on that path. Are we not, Kanji, of removing that completely erroneous supposition and story? We are separate, therefore we will defend ourselves, therefore we will react to everything in that defense, or we will push forward to try and gratify ourselves.
Well put. And to put that passage in context, that's pointing to an incident. No, it's fine. That's fine. It's pointing to an incident in which at the age of 5, I was lying on a sofa and suddenly had the epiphany. I'm Steve Rule. I'm Steve Rule. And I ran out and told my sister. And who was Iron
That's
and Clay.
Great.
Yeah. And great. So you're right, though. It's you know, I describe it as the fall from grace. And it's complicated, isn't it? Because we certainly do experience this realm of relative phenomena as one in which there's a me and a you, and there is a separation that we need to navigate every moment of every day. And at the same time, there's the interconnectedness of the oneness. And that's what we tend to so easily lose sight of, is the interconnectedness of the oneness. So to get back to that primal experience of no separation, in addition to realizing that self and other are separate, holding both simultaneously. As Dogen said in the Genja Koan fascicle of the Shobogenzo, to study the way is to study the self. So that points to the separation. That points to the individuation. Right. And but he also went on to say that to study the self is to lose the self, and to lose the self is to experience the 10,000 things of the universe. So that experience of losing the self is the experience of that oneness and interconnectedness.
Yeah. It is a lifetime of work, though.
It is.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, I was blown away meeting somebody who didn't have that, you know, separation going on. I wouldn't have put it in those terms. Now when I think back, it was kind of like a computer that just does the right thing for everyone else. There's nothing of its own needing anything. And, you know, that's an extraordinary experience. Basically, this is still a human being. Buddha was a human being, you know. And
exactly.
We all obviously have that potential.
Well, you know, in terms of all of us having that potential, I woke up last night in the middle of the night from a dream with the phrase, clear all the channels, clear all the channels. And I think that's part of what you're pointing to is, you know, we clear all the channels and all the obscurations disappear. And then we do have that complete presence of no separation, which is also the complete presence of an open heart. Yeah. And that's the loving compassion.
Yeah. Is it Ram Dass called it loving awareness? That was his big teaching at in the last years of his life when he was in Maui. A beautiful teaching, just enabling people to get out of the story, the head trip, the attachment to thoughts, to using the breath to go into the center of your being. And I am loving awareness. And eventually, there's just a love and awareness.
Right.
Beyond the I am part.
Exactly. Opening up the heart and also opening up the hara, and the hara being the wisdom seat. So opening up to that wisdom and also to the loving compassion. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. So another through line here is you said ultimately, for people out there, Zazen is a very rigorous practice. Okay. This isn't like the slobby bhaktis like me and others back in the day, although we all did Vipassana meditate. Meditation is still very much a part of our practice, but we're talking about rigorous, very rigorous, and not for nothing, right? We all have that chatter. Wouldn't it be nice not to have that constant chatter? At least, actually, the chatter will be there. The reactivity and the attachment to the chatter, the grasping goes away. I mean, and this is one of the byproducts of strong meditation practice, right?
Yeah, and the chatter goes away too. Of course, it always comes back, but yeah it does subside. Yeah,
yeah, but it's more beside the point.
Right, the point, yeah.
So you say you sat Zazen for the same reason Thoreau went to the woods. Because I wish to live deliberately, he wrote, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I die, discover that I had not lived. But I think the most maybe thing to parse is living deliberately. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that? Because I think there can be trap there. Because of the doing, and using the will, and thinking control, those are tough things, and yet there is a certitude about I would call it living deliberately, doing your dharma.
Doing your dharma, yeah. No, this is a good point you're raising. So living deliberately can be complicated by obstructions of the will. Absolutely. This passage you're citing derives from when I was just beginning practice, and there's an element of determination of both intention and a vow. That's really important, not only in beginning practice, but sustaining practice. But there's also an important element of surrender and finding, again, we keep returning in our conversation to this sense of balance, of equal poise. So balancing intention with surrender in practice and living deliberately, I think, has a lot to do simply with living in a way that's awake rather than sleepwalking. And it's so easy to, especially in our society, which encourages it, to lapse back into some kind of soporific state of sleepwalking. And what we're really being called to do is to stay awake. As everybody knows, that's simply what the word Buddha means. It means to be awake, to be an awakened one. Mm-hmm. So to live in a way that's fully alive. What I use to framework it is be clear, be kind, be present. That's really what it is to live in a way that's awake. Be clear about the nature of reality, not deluded. Be kind, not self-centered, and be present, not distracted. Be clear, be kind, be present. Mm. So simple.
Good man.
So simple, but also so challenging. And Zazen is very rigorous for that reason, breaking down the conditioning that prevents us from being clear, being kind, being present.
Yeah.
So it takes some deliberation, takes some effort, takes some will. It takes some rigor. You know, Zazen is not simply a relaxation technique as it's branded and marketed in our society, in our consumerist, celebrity-worshipping cultures, our secular materialist culture. You know, I tell people sometimes if all you want to do is relax, just lie in a hammock with a margarita. But, you know, that's not what Zazen is about.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, that sounds good. But, you know, if you want to be clear, be kind, and be present and live in a way that's fundamentally sane, then, you know, Zazen is one technique that I've found in my own experience can really be conducive to helping to make that happen.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things, of course, your deep commitment to Zazen on one hand, and on the other, you've been a writer in your life. I mean, all the way, you know, it was noted when you were in high school, I believe. So then ensued a dichotomy, which most people on the spiritual path, it doesn't have to be Zen, experience the dichotomy between I'm doing spiritual practice, quote unquote, and then the rest of the time I'm, you know, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a student, I'm a advertising executive, whatever. Mm-hmm. And those two absolutely stay completely at odds with each other. And but talk about how you managed to work through it, because it was something that you really needed to work through.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing this up, Raghu. What you're pointing to, I think, speaks directly to the challenges that lay practitioners are encountering in American Buddhism. My particular dilemma is related to that, but also specifically has to do with the tension, as I experience it, between being a writer, which for me, for better or for worse, invokes this entire Western romantic with capital R, obviously, Western romantic tradition of what it means to be a writer, which is fundamentally self-expression. It's about the self. And then I've got this Zen Buddhist practice, which is fundamentally about realizing no self. And so the tension for me that I'm still working with and living with has to do with how do I balance this Western romantic tradition of writing coming out of the tradition, you know, of early 19th century of Keats and Shelley and Coleridge and the Bronte sisters and Blake and so on, with this Buddhist tradition of cultivating no self and holding both in harmony so that they're not in conflict.
Exactly.
It's ongoing for me. I think I'm finding a little more balance, to go back to that word that we're coming back to so frequently here today. But it's an ongoing issue for me, and it's fascinating. I come to it with curiosity, and I investigate it as an act of inquiry. But it is ongoing.
Good to have a sense of humor.
Sure is. Yeah, sure helps. Lightens the load.
Yeah, because we're so, I mean, we're absolutely so self-serious. It's troubling.
Yeah, especially sometimes in spiritual circles. So.
Yeah, really. Really. What's this? So there's a term called Muga, and I've never heard that before, the Zen principle. Explain that. I mean, I want to know what that, because it's self becomes erased. I understand, but.
You understand that, yeah. This is a term that Basho invoked frequently. It's complete identification with the object. In his case, the object that's being written about. So the idea essentially is you become the pine tree that you're writing about. There's no separation of self and other. You know, we have a tradition, again, in the Western romantic tradition of, you know, the negative capability that Keats talked about, or the objective correlative later in the modernist tradition that Eliot talked about. It's not quite the same thing. This tradition of Muga is about direct identification. no separation.
And that very intimacy, tantric, right?
That intimacy. I think it's tantric. That intimacy, I think, is tantric. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you could say that.
Yeah. That's cool. I'd like to investigate a little bit more. By the way, you have some neat quotes in here that you've gotten from other people at head chapters. This George Eliot one is from Middlemarch. It's an uneasy lot at best to be present at this great spectacle of life and never to be liberated from a small, hungry, shivering self.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? I was so stunned. I was reading Middlemarch, and I came across that. And, you know, in a mid-19th century novel, there it is.
Yeah, it's just perfect.
Yeah.
The other thing that's cool is some of the koans that are, of course, they're a primary teaching thing in Zen. Shall I read one? I'm going to read one. A monk asked 9th century Chan teacher, Cao Shan, "What are you going to do about yourself?" Teacher said, "Who can do anything about me?" "Why don't you kill yourself?" the monks asked. "No place to lay hold of," the teacher said. These are so great.
And, you know, that's a part of the book where I'm really looking deeply into the themes of death and loss. That's the part of the book about people I've known and loved who committed suicide. And so having to go deeply into what it means to confront mortality and what is it, the death of the self, in regard to suicide, and looking at that, trying to understand that.
I used to talk to Ram Dass quite a bit about that. And it is a very complex subject, obviously. There, even to the point, though, I mean, let's just think about it, because you and I are going to be dealing with this in the next 10, 20 years, probably. How many people have we seen that take on extreme measures, you know, regarding preserving life, preserving their life, fending off, dealing with that ultimate mystery? I mean, it's pretty prevalent that we do that. And there is, I mean, I guess I do believe, and I'm saying this now in a fairly healthy moment, right? But I do believe that their karma is real. And the span of one's life, and the reality that it's not a moment too soon or a moment too late that you go through the bardos is real to me. So trying to elongate that is a kind of weird concept. And that maybe, you know, you can think about that with people who are so unhappy with their lives and just basically, you know, have probably tremendous chemical depression issues. That they will abrogate their lives by suicide. And is that enough? Is there a karmic effect there? I'm absolutely positive that there is. Is there another situation where it wouldn't be? I'm sure that's true too. So, you know, this is it's a very, very difficult subject, but
it is. It's difficult and complicated, and we only have a few minutes left, so it's a big topic. Right. But just no, I think you're right. I think there's a karmic element. I also, in the book, I explore, and I'll say this quickly, explore the possibility that suicide, and as I say in the book, I know 5 people in my life, good friends, as well as my younger sister and a former girlfriend who remained very close to me, who committed suicide. So I've really had to deal with this. And I also think there's the possibility that it's a spiritual emergency that is misapprehended, that what the spiritual emergency consists of is a desire to have the small ego self diminished, and it becomes misread as a literal desire to annihilate the self. And so this self-annihilation in the extremity of the suicidal ideation, which has been described as entering this black tunnel in which everything confirms the decision.
Yeah.
Within that black tunnel of suicidal ideation, the spiritual emergency, which essentially is healthy, of wanting to diminish the grasping on the small self, when it's misread as a literal desire to annihilate the self, it can end up as an act of suicide, tragically enough.
Yeah. There's a beautiful thing here, and it really sits with our whole tradition. It's just one simple line from you, really.
Hey.
When it comes to exploring the Dharma, we are in this together.
Hey.
And Ram Dass's famous phrase, we are walking each other home. We are all walking each other home, which is the same as how you just expressed it.
Hey.
And I think for anybody out there listening to this or watching it on YouTube, I think that this is a very important principle, and it's real. And I know many people feel very alone, either circumstantially or even if they're in a family, a loving, supportive family. There is, again, karma is involved. We bring stuff with us from previous incarnations, and we are working them out. And I think that the knowledge of as we said earlier in the podcast from Thich Nhat Hanh, the next guru is the Sangha, satsang, community.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's really something to gravitate towards, so people can become part of whatever possible community is in your area, physically or like with on ramdas.org, we have a fellowship all around the world. The person who runs it actually just told me, oh, yeah, we just got one started up in Lebanon. I go,
wow.
Lebanon? Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So, and it's virtual. So even if it's virtual, whatever it may be, it could be your local yoga center and doing some chanting, your local Zen center to do Zazen practice. Whatever it may be, that the getting together of other like-minded souls is a big deal. It is, we are walking each other home. Uh-huh. Or when we do this practice, we're in this together, you know, absolutely 100%.
Yeah, it's a very big deal. And it's true. I mean, solitude can be healthy, but isolation can kill. And we live in a society that values rugged individualism and emphasizes independence. And when it becomes toxic and dysfunctional, it becomes that kind of alienation that you were talking about in your experience as a teenager earlier in our discussion.
Yeah.
So this kind of alienation can be surmounted through community, through Sangha. And that's why it is so important to emphasize that Sangha, in fact, is one of the three jewels, one of the three treasures.
Mm-hmm. And the Buddha said, when Ananda said, which of the three is the one, whoever said it. And or Ananda said, I heard that the Sangha is the one and the Sangha is everything.
Yeah, the Sangha is everything. Yeah.
So, that's worthwhile to keep in mind, especially when we're going through tough stuff, which all of us do.
Well, it is. I mean, it's important to bear in mind that we're always being held. We're always being held. We're always interconnected. It's easy to lose sight of that sometimes, but, there's the traditional Zen saying, you can never fall off of the earth. We're always being held.
Yeah. And now there's other quotes in this book. We're just about running out of time, but there's other quotes in this book. And, from some of the Bodhidharma, who are some Hoshan and Hung Po, Hakuan. I mean, these are all, and I'm not that familiar with Zen. I'm pretty familiar just because I speak to people like you all the time.
Right.
On podcasts. So I get to learn. So I'm just trying to pick one out. What is the holy truth of Buddhism? Mm-hmm. The emperor asked Bodhidharma, right?
Yeah.
And Bodhidharma answered, completely full emptiness, no limits, and there's nothing holy about it. That's so, so great.
Yeah, I love it.
And we should just say one last thing, and emptiness, which is the most misconstrued Buddhist term, I believe, in the whole lexicon. And it is not about nothingness, everybody. Absolutely not. Bob Thurman, who I think, you know,
I know Bob, yeah.
Yeah, you know Bob. So he calls it, emptiness is the womb of bliss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it contains everything.
Yeah, exactly. And self, we're talking about, yes, self is absolutely abrogated by practice, and the self we're talking about is that little guy in the head that is judging, commenting. That's what our movie of me thing is about. Actually, my friend Krishnadas thought of it, and he talks about you wake up in the morning, and you're the producer, the writer, the director, the lead actor. In fact, you even write the reviews.
So yeah.
That's the movie of me, and that's the self that we are engaging with, and that's what you are talking about in this book, engaging it, of course, through Zen and its philosophy and practices. And there's the coup d'etat kanji. And this is from Ikkyu. How do I pronounce it?
Ikkyu.
Ikkyu.
Yeah.
Who I've encountered before, and maybe I have some connection with him because this speaks to me. One glimpse of the true human being, and we are in love. Is that great?
That
is so great. I can't even tell you. I was just at a big event commemorating the 50th anniversary of Neem Karoli Baba leaving that body in Taos. We have a big monkey temple. It was just a ball. And but there was over 1,000 people and not that big an area, right, on this land in the middle of Taos. And so meeting a lot of people, and because we're in this field of energy at this moment, everyone was really, it wasn't hard to see and get a glimpse of the true human being. So we had a lot of love moments. It was really wonderful. So
beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you for being here, Kanji.
Thank you, Raghu. I'm really looking forward to a movie of me, movie of we. Congratulations.
Yeah, let's see what happens with that.
Yeah.
And everybody, we will have in the show notes a way for you to get a hold of Appalachian. It's Appalachian. You said Appalachian, but I lived in North Carolina for a while. They were telling me Appalachian.
You're absolutely right. In the South, it's Appalachian. In the North, it's Appalachian.
Really?
Yeah. Yep.
So it's a new fact. Anyhow, links will be there for you to order the book, get the book, and connect with Kanji, who has a website, and you'll be advised of his doings. And again, it's been a pleasure. And,
real pleasure for me, really, Raghu. Thank you so much. Enjoyed every moment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Everybody, we'll see you. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network, and we shall see you next week.